Hello, and welcome to a very special series I am moderating on diversity, equity, and inclusivity by CME Outfitters. This CML briefcase is entitled Take Action, Optimizing Equity in Mental Health Care. This program is supported by an educational grant provided by Johnson & Johnson. My name is Dr. Monica Peek, and I'm the Ellen H. Block Professor of Health Justice in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago, where I also serve as the Vice Chair of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. I'm also a health services researcher and a bioethicist, as well as a practicing clinical internist. And one of my great joys over the past 2 decades has really been taking care of primary care patients. And in part of that role, I do a lot of primary mental health care. And so depression, anxiety is part and parcel of what I do, in addition to treating diabetes and hypertension and asthma. And so I'm really excited today to talk about mental health care with a professional who focuses on mental health care. And I'm delighted to be joined today by one of my distinguished colleagues, dear friends, Dr. Rakesh Jain. Dr. Jain, would you mind introducing yourself today?
Yes, Dr. Peek, Monica, it's lovely to be with you. And hello, my dear colleagues. My name is Rakesh Jain. And just like Dr. Peek, I take care of lots and lots of patients who really are in need of help. I do specialize now in mental health, but in my previous life, I was an internist. I am a professor. I'm a clinical professor of psychiatry at Texas Tech University School of Medicine in Permian Basin. And in addition to seeing patients, it is my pleasure and honor to do a considerable amount of teaching of residents and fellows and medical students. But perhaps the best thing I do all day long is learn myself. And therefore, this particular topic is very close to my heart. So, Monica, let's get into it.
Let's go. All right. So before we begin, I just want to note that this particular program was designed to build upon foundational concepts that we've already covered before and some of our previous DEI activities. And so to learn more about the impact of systemic racism on healthcare and health disparities, as well as how race and ethnicity may present in the field of mental health, we encourage you to sort of engage in our long, sort of diverse library of foundational programs, which are linked here. And so before we begin, I just want to clarify that as colleagues and mutual admirers of each other, Rakesh and I have decided that we would refer to each other by our first names, just as reflection of how we'd like our session to go, just full of fun and admiration. And so I'm looking forward to our case discussion today and our candid conversation. I always learn so much from you, so I'm really very excited about this. And so let me start by first reviewing our first learning objective for our program today, which is to identify health inequities in the diagnosis, the treatment, and outcomes for patients with mental health disorders, and we'll be focusing on major depressive disorder. And so before we begin, I want to open us up with an audience question just to get a sense of how confident you are as our audience with some of the things we'll be discussing today. And so please just be anonymous and transparent. Well, I say be transparent because we will be anonymous in your responses. So, how confident are you in your ability to identify disparities in access to healthcare and other social and economic resources for patients who have mental health conditions? And you'll see that there's sort of a range, almost a Likert type scale of responses. And so, just pick one number that fits that best fits how you're feeling, and then we'll move right into our patient case. And so, to highlight some of the disparities in the diagnosis and management of patients who have mental health disorders, we're going to start with a case.
Yes, by the way, the question that you asked the audience is so important. It's important because I think to take a measure of your own self, where you are with great honesty on these topics is really important. Self-insight and recognizing there's room for improvement is so important, so I appreciate it. So,
Lifelong learning.
lifelong learning and lifelong honesty, right? It's a constant process of self-evaluation. I'm very delighted to present this case to you. This is Ale, 18-year-old Latina transgender man with a medical history of obesity and hyperlipidemia, and is following up with mental health professional. After really following up, because the primary care had referred because of continuing symptoms of depression. Now, he has seen religious leaders in the past, but believes that it wasn't very helpful. So, would you perhaps take over in terms of audience response here?
Absolutely. So thank you so much for setting the stage for who Ale is. And so before we move into some more of his clinical case, I want to ask the audience about some of the disparities in major depressive disorder and which question they think might be most accurate. And so you'll see the question on the screen. And so for our audience, the answer is C. And so, Rakesh, would you mind walking through why C is the right answer and why some of the others might not be correct?
Yeah, and as a health policy and epidemiologist yourself, and I do the same thing, these are necessary, important facts for everybody to recognize. So, as you can see on this particular slide, disparities in diagnosis across the board are a challenge in America, but there are pockets of concern. So, while the prevalence of diagnosed MDD might be lower in Black and Latina communities as compared to white communities, the challenges when an individual from those communities belongs to the LGBTQIA plus community, then the risk actually is magnified quite dramatically. And those youth not only don't access healthcare as much as they need to, they do it far less than their white compatriots. On top of that, there are more barriers to seeking care and utilization rates in such a population. Ali is from the Latina community. The healthcare rate access is only about half that of non-Hispanic white patients. And of course, they do seek out religious care often, but not necessarily is it helpful to all patients, as I'm showing here. Therefore, this underscores the importance of collaborative care with both spiritual and religious leaders in all communities, but in particular, communities that we're having a discussion on.
Absolutely. And this sort of brings to light the importance of intersectionality, where people may have multiple identities that are marginalized and are having difficulty navigating safe spaces based on their gender or race or ethnicity or, sexual orientation. And when you have multiple of those, the number of safe spaces where you can go and be your whole self gets smaller and smaller, particularly if you're not in a major metropolitan area. And so seeking care can be all the more challenging. And so thank you for highlighting all of those things and the ways in which they may have interplay. So let's check back in with our patient Ale and his case.
Yeah, let's do that. But let me reflect for a moment on what you just said, which I think is so true. The world is complicated enough when you are a young adult coming to life in America, but it gets particularly complicated when there are issues where you have a combination of physical health problems, mental health problems, you might belong to a minority community, and on top of that, you might belong to the LGBTQIA plus community. So you said it beautifully. These margins get smaller and smaller. The space gets smaller and smaller. So we as clinicians often become the safe place for these individuals. So there's an extra responsibility we have. So let's talk about Ali a little bit further. So the blood pressure, as you can see, 125, 86, heart rate 88, height 5'9", weight is higher than this individual would like, or we as clinicians would like. The BMI is at a 34. But the presenting symptoms are depressed mood, increased appetite, tension, worry, anxiety, concentration, restlessness. Oh my goodness. Now check out the PHQ-9. Well, in the past 15, historically, though, I'm sorry, it's 15 now. Historically, it's been 22. So it tells me some progress has been made, but at a 15, I'm still quite concerned about Ale. The MDQ, the mood disorder questionnaire, which is rapidly becoming kind of a standard bearer in terms of screening out or screening in for bipolar disorder or bipolar spectrum disorders, is for the most part a reassuring 3 out of 13, though one has to finish our full interview. Previous medications. This is where things really get interesting, Monica.
Mm-hmm.
Has been on Sertralin before, but quit because of sexual dysfunction. Duloxetine, not effective. In fact, felt worse on it. Mirtazapine, well, was a good choice, but weight gain was the reason for quitting it. So the diagnosis, I think quite appropriately at this time, is recurrent moderate major depression without psychotic features with moderate anxious distress and possibly mixed features. So this individual, in most clinical hands, would be classified as just major depression. And I think it's probably a wise idea, Monica, to do what is important, which is to label this patient appropriately as major depression for sure, but also as treatment resistant, because the definition of treatment resistance is failure of two antidepressants, at least two antidepressants, that have been given for an adequate length and duration. So I'm really worried about Ale.
And as clinicians, a lot of times when I see patients in my office, the challenge that I have is that a lot of times patients may not remember the name of the medication or how long they were on it. Wasn't quite clear if it was a side effect or they just felt kind of funny. Who stopped it? They stopped it, or, you know, and so trying to determine, is this going to be treatment resistant, you know, or if it was just an incomplete trial, it's hard for me sometimes to make that delineation.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm 100% with you. The worst thing I can do for a patient is to call them treatment resistant when they actually aren't.
Yeah.
So what I do is exactly what you do. Do my very best to dig out the information. Sometimes people will tell me I took that blue pill, I took that white pill. That's a challenge. So sometimes we call the pharmacy with the patient's help. That can be extraordinarily helpful. Sometimes asking if there are family members who can show me what the bottle is at home that they took the medication. So you're completely right. While this is a bit difficult to do, it's worth engaging in that conversation to make sure we have the right diagnosis. It's called the rule of 4 Ds, and you might really like this along with our colleagues. Make sure you have the right diagnosis. Make sure you chose the right drug as best as you could for that patient. Make sure you chose the right dose. And then the final D is make sure the duration was at least 6 weeks or longer. At least in Ale's case, that was the case. After meeting him, it was clear that he knew the names of his medications, the dose was correct, and he did meet criteria for treatment-resistant depression.
Excellent. So now we're ready to ask the audience a question about disparities in the treatment of major depressive disorder and which one they think might be the most accurate before we sort of move on to next steps in therapy. Okay, so for our audience, the answer is D. And so can you walk us through why D is the right answer and again, why some of the others may not be as correct?
Yeah, they're all leaning in the right direction. So yes, you're right. The answer is D. And let me alert the clinicians about what's the landscape today. So on the slide, you can see 4 boxes. Let me cover those quickly with you. So on the top left, the truth is the truth. Treatment rates for depression are indeed lower for Black and Latin patients as compared to white patients. But how much? Well, prescription treatment shows us that it's 33% lower for Latin communities and 13% lower for Black communities. Okay, we got a challenge here. On the right side, on the top, target or treatment for MDD declined at greater rates. It declined across the board, but it really declined at greater rates for Latin communities from 2018 to 2020 as compared to the Black or white communities. This is worrisome, is it not? On the bottom left, counseling for diagnosed MDD is 21% lower for Latin communities than for white communities for a whole host of reasons. I'm sure we'll be talking about why that discrepancy exists. And then, of course, at the bottom right, differences in treatment become more significant for patients from underserved racial and ethnic populations, when they're moving. So it's already bad when they present, but when they move from first to second and then from second to third line treatments for major depression, it sadly drops even lower than the white community. So disparities in treatment are pretty extensive for this population.
And I would imagine, I'm going to be interesting to what you're going to tell me, that some of that is that the as we jump ahead, that the some of the medications make it more expensive, and that people may get more frustrated and feel like this just isn't working, and so kind of fall out of care. I don't know. So I'll be interested to hear what you have to say. Let's check back in with our patient case and see how he's doing.
Yeah, you are right on what you just said. Access is more difficult, but sometimes family support can be inadequate because of lack of psychoeducation about the biopsychosocial aspects of the disorder. So this is a significant challenge in the Latin community, in other communities. And I wish there was just one etiology, Monica, for this, but there are many. But instead of feeling pessimistic about it, this is my thinking. If there are many problems, that means there are many doors that I can open in terms of opportunities to help patients like Ali. So let's just get right into it. So Ali is reporting current medications. This is a newer antidepressant, which is a combination of 45 milligrams of dextromethorphan and 105 milligrams of bupropion, which is given twice daily. 8 week exposure, so good adherence, good medicine, good dose, all that happened. And what was the end result? Slightly effective, but not helpful. Not helpful for a number of things, including for insomnia. Patient is now getting a little bit desperate, feels like nothing is working, and has concerns about trying any other medications that will cause sexual dysfunction and weight gain. Ali's very concerned, appropriately so, about the weight that he already carries and certainly doesn't want it to increase. Currently is having increasing suicidal thoughts, but thankfully no plan. And these thoughts tend to happen more at night when he's having trouble with sleep. And the healthcare professional is thankfully very engaged in Ellie's care and discusses treatment options using shared decision-making tools for the treatment of major depression.
It's really interesting, this case. I'm so glad that they're bringing up this intersection of health conditions, because overweight and obesity and adipose-based chronic disorders, something I just learned about, overlap so much with so many other conditions. And we have so many issues around our armamentarium for mental health conditions that are associated with weight gain and sexual dysfunction, that his concerns are related to so many other people who may have diabetes and already have issues with erectile dysfunction, or already have obesity that sort of pushed them into diabetes, and diabetes and depression already have that overlay. And so this is real world. These are real world issues that we have to be thinking about. So I'm really excited about this case. I'm going to ask our audience what they think. So given Ale's symptoms and the lack of response to previous treatments, which option do they think would be most appropriate for this patient? And so for our audience, the answer is D. And so can you walk us through the options, and again, why D would be the best one?
And you're right, Monica. This is as real a patient as it gets, right? It's never super clean. There's lots of challenges. It's real world. It's real world. And I'm so glad Ale's case really pushes us into appreciating that treatment of depression is never really simple, but it can get really complicated. So I do think option A isn't correct. So the patient's already tried, as we articulated before, several serotonin modulators. So it's illogical to go there again after three of them have not worked. So that's not what the treatment guidelines would support anyways. Changing is what they would support. B, lithium and tricyclic. Well, those are both outstanding medications, but for the right condition, Lithium carbonate would not be appropriate for augmentation strategy here. It's not approved. It's not recommended. Same is true with tricyclics. We have a patient who is reporting suicidality. I would not want to give a tricyclic, which can be lethal in just a 10-day dose. ECT, I think it's way too early to consider that. It is an effective intervention, but perhaps ECT is not appropriate at this juncture. But please do keep that thought in mind for down the road. Augmentation, now that's what the treatment guidelines talk about. So in treatment-resistant depression, augmentation with whatever appropriate agent is recommended. And I would actually say, I hope no one answered E. I don't know. I say that only because that should worry us. In a patient like this, we should have at least a game plan of what to do. And by the way, treatment-resistant depression is not rare. A full third of patients with major depression slip into TRD. Hence, this conversation is such an important one.
Excellent. All right. So let's talk a little bit about disparities in care and disparities in outcomes for patients. And so, Rakesh, can you tell us a little bit about the data that we have and some of the things that we need to be thinking about as far as examples and clinical pearls as clinicians?
Yeah, Monica, please buckle up because
Bumpy right ahead.
bumpy ride ahead, and it's going to be a long, bumpy ride. But confronting our own challenges is step one in solving any problem, right? So the truth of the matter is America doesn't do very well by its citizens when it comes to mental health,
Right.
period. That is the sad truth. And we actually put a lot of burden on primary care, who's already very thinly stretched. We ask a lot of your specialty. But I must say this, it's not just an American problem, it's an American problem of greater magnitude for certain groups of individuals. So, for example, Latin patients, Black patients, sometimes Asian patients really are not as well served. And as soon as an added issue steps in, such as LGBTQI plus individuals, it becomes far more complicated, not just in terms of medical management, but biopsychosocial management.
Yes.
They often don't have a stable place to live. There's often great family conflict. There's school disruption. There's pushback from the community. Sometimes religious leaders, as I'm showing you here, themselves are not a source of support. They become a challenge. Suicidality happens at a higher rate in these individuals, not just suicidal thinking, but completed suicide. Social media often becomes a refuge for such individuals, but sometimes it's no longer a refuge. It literally becomes addiction, it becomes toxicity. So such individuals spend a lot of time in digital spaces, and sometimes that itself is the problem. So as a clinician like you and I who are interested in helping these individuals, I have to now start evaluating them for how are they consuming digital interaction. Is it good for them? Is it not good for them? And often they find spaces in the digital world that they feel is helping them, but often that is not the case. So these social drivers of health that our patients experience, particularly if they have these added complexities, are, as you can see on this slide, huge. There's a reason why there are so many references here. This issue has been well studied, and sadly, Monica, they all point in one direction: trouble ahead. So we clinicians had best be very alert to it.
Yes, I think a lot about digital technologies and how, in hindsight, we're thinking about cigarettes and how doctors used to, advertise cigarettes and just we would give them out, all the military and kids in school and, how benign we thought it was and even perhaps even good for you, the menthol, and how much we're learning now is bad for you. And even just recently, how many schools are saying, you know what, this is going to be a digital free space. And, I think we're starting to turn the corner, but like how much harm has already been done? And so it's there's so many, yeah, it's a challenge.
I know the smartphone is a modern miracle. It's done so much good, but I entirely agree with you. I entirely agree with you that in some individuals, this device for good ends up really harming them. As a result, as a clinician, it is obligatory upon me because I practice in 2024 and I'll practice in 2025 that I get a sense the way I check out their health behaviors, I check out their eating behaviors and their social behaviors. I really do need to start checking into their digital use behaviors to see if it's an essentially a good thing for them or it's a bad thing for them. And what I've found in individuals like Ali that we have talked about, very often digital utilization is so excessive, it's actually harmful to them.
Yes. And but at the same time, for people who again are struggling to find safe spaces because of all these identities, they may only be able to find those spaces
Right.
in an online support group or in some sort of digital space. And so it's really complicated. Yeah, it's but we have to be able to have additional tools to help people navigate and the ability to monitor, it's not a pie eating contest. You've gotta know when to stop. All righty. So before we move on to our second learning objective, I want to ask our audience another question. And so now that we've finished our first objective, I want you to re-rate yourself and your confidence and your ability to identify disparities in access to healthcare and other social and economic resources for patients with mental health conditions. And again, we have sort of a scale from 0 to 9. Think about where you sit on this scale and give us one of those numbers. So that brings us to our second learning objective, which is as a member of the healthcare team to implement actionable collaborative strategies to improve health equity. So once again, I'm going to start by asking our audience another confidence question. And so you'll see the question on our screen. And so the question is, how confident are you in your ability to implement actionable collaborative strategies to improve health equity? And that's going to be on a scale, again, from 0 to 9. And so if you can just respond to how you're feeling about that. And so to help the audience with actionable strategies to help improve health equity, I think we should first consider the impact of major depressive disorder through a racial and ethnic lens around social drivers of health. And so, Rakesh, could you give our audience some insight and experience from you as a practitioner about how a patient like Ali may uniquely experience difficulties with major depressive disorder? We've talked a bit about that, but can you sort of just like wrap it up in one space around all of the things that may be impacting him uniquely?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to. That, by the way, the question you asked was one that I was trying to answer, the one about how confident you are. And I put myself at between a 6 and a 7. And I actually like that. I like the fact that I am not all that confident and I'm in the learning mode of what else can I do. So let's.
No one else who's listening should be more than a 6 or a 7.
I agree
Just
with
putting
you.
that out there.
I agree with you. That's a good point because the world is changing. Our patients are changing. Having confidence is important. But in this situation, I think your point, Monica, is overconfidence would harm us. And I get that point. Yeah. Let's talk about our patient. Our patient is really challenged in so many different ways. So let's dive into that a little bit. So the fact that our patient is Latina is actually, interestingly, a known challenge in the sense that such individuals, based on epidemiological studies, are more likely to report discrimination, not just for the race they have, but also for the fact that accessing mental health care services is a challenge for a variety of reasons. So they have rates of depression, particularly if LGBTQIA issues step in, that are elevated. But on top of that, as I said before, they don't access help that much, and they really don't access help that much for a variety of reasons, especially when the first antidepressant doesn't work. That's challenge one. Number two, unhoused youth issue is significant in our individual patients who have LGBTQIA plus issues.
Yes.
It
and
is.
It's so
they
heartbreaking.
Often, pardon me?
I said it's so heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. We sometimes couch it in benign terms like couch surfing. Oh, this is just couch surfing, but it's much worse than that. They are unhoused. They're not just unhoused physically, but they're also unmoored from their family and their support system.
Yes.
And the shame and embarrassment and fears and financial issues and transportation issues.
And feeling rejected.
That leads to challenges. So to examine such individuals' challenges through the lens, as you said earlier, of racial and ethnic social drivers of health, I think is a clinical necessity. And I'm very glad you brought up that topic.
Excellent. So such important things for us to understand. So can you give us some insight into ways that we might want to screen for social drivers of health within the context of mental health care?
I'd be happy to. And I'm glad you asked that, because getting a measure of our enemy is good, but hand-wringing isn't going to solve our problem. We need actionable items, as you said. So I have a really powerful slide to show you where we are able to look at some actionable items. How do we screen? And then, of course, based on the screening, we will take appropriate steps. There are specific checklists that we can use. I have recently looked up SNOMED, and that can be quite helpful in better understanding what else can I appropriately classify the patient in terms of their challenges, not just the DSM diagnosis, but what are the challenges do we have? Many systems are now incorporating a formalized assessment of social drivers of health for our patients. We should be doing it for all patients, but for patients like the one who we're discussing, that is a particular need. And you will like this. Even the wonderful WHO has stepped in, and they have several tools as I'm talking here, along with other institutions, how we can assess for social drivers of health challenges in their individual patients. But if I can break it down, I would like to break it down into six buckets of challenges that we should be thinking about with everybody, but particularly this patient. So we should look at, what is the economic stability? Will they have insurance coverage? Do they not have insurance coverage? How do I cover them? Will they be able to afford co-pays, for example? What is the neighborhood situation like? What is their physical environment like? If they do take a medication, do they even have a safe place to store it? Mm-hmm. And they make a phone call to a therapist where they can have privacy. What about their educational system? Are they in school? Are they out of school? Do they need to be in school, or do we need to find an alternate way to get them education? Food insecurity, which you very early on mentioned in your comments, Monica, it is a significant issue. It really is something to think about. Is the part of the reason why our patient have obesity because he lives in a food desert, an island where literally doesn't have access to healthier foods? We don't know what's going on here. And by the way, what about the community? What support does any individual have? What is the social context in which major depression is being seen by both our patient and people surrounding them? What about the healthcare system? What about the healthcare system? Does it have a system in place to cover the needs of our individuals? Is it a sympathetic system? Is it a difficult system to access? Is there someone who can help the patient navigate the complexity of a health system? This individual now needs help from a internal medicine colleague as well as a mental health colleague. What is the form of communication? And we do all of that because ultimately the goal, as you can see on the slide, is health wellness. And that is a basic human right of every American. But for this individual who we're talking about, for them to access it, it's not just he who has to really up their game. We have to up their game. Right. And that's why this conversation is just so powerful.
Absolutely. And one of the things that really stands out to me when we're thinking about these social drivers and what needs to be in place that I hadn't really thought about in the context of mental health was the ability to talk privately. And that speaks not only phone access, but their living space. You know, do they have their own room? Or are they living, you know, are they in a shelter? Or is there any place and space that's safe for them to have a communication about their mental health issues? And that is different than, you know, coming in to have a diabetes check or, you know, whatever. Most of that occurs in the hospital, whereas a lot of mental health care may be occurring, you know, via telephone or other kinds of things where you don't have to be in person. And so then it really becomes important that that space outside of the hospital or the clinic setting is a safe space.
That's right. It's challenging. You said it accurately.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up.
This is a challenging issue for us healthcare providers, but because it's challenging is why we need to step in. Absolutely. May I present a little bit more on this individual?
Because yes, let's go back to Ali.
Yeah, let's do that. And I want to congratulate whoever Ali's clinician is, because they actually did an assessment. And as you can see on this particular slide, after examining for these social drivers of health in our patient, several issues were found. For example, transportation. Doesn't have their own car. Public transportation in their community may be quite challenged. Mm-hmm. A lot of social media. You and I were right when we were worrying about social media use. Way more than 3 hours per day. That's the only way I can connect with people, is what he is telling us. But on the other hand, this social media outlet for our dear patient is also a problem, because there's a lot of bullying. The bullying may be because he might have disclosed his mental health condition and he might be told, what are you talking about? Forget about it. Psychiatrists and primary care, no, just do your own thing, man, whatever the case might be. The patient is part of a religious community, but is not getting all the support they need and comes from a very large family where, yeah, he actually does not have his own room, sleeps with the multiple younger siblings, and that's adds to his insomnia. And as we talked, as we talked about couch surfing, that actually has been a sad, sad challenge for him as well. So doesn't it sound like a lot of the patients you and I see?
Absolutely. People who are really juggling multiple challenging situations, just trying to make every day get by, and things that if you didn't already have major depression might put you in a depressive state, just trying to, you know, live your life. So thank you for having us think not only about his clinical disorder, but the social factors that can be contributing to it, the social factors that we need to be thinking about as we try and create a comprehensive management plan. And so now that the team has screened for his social drivers, it sounds like there's some things that are actionable that the team can do to help improve the outcomes for his care. And so let's think about what those are.
Yes. Biopsychosocial is the disorder that we call major depression. The treatment of it is also biopsychosocial. It's not just medications.
That's
You're
right.
Entirely right. Psychosocial issues can make an antidepressant not work. So here we go. This team really is a wonderful team. And look what they did. They obtained a case manager to assist our patient with housing, getting good, appropriate health insurance, in this case, Medicaid. The process has started. The patient did not have a therapist. Let's find a therapist, a counselor, who is sensitive to his individual needs. Hopefully even is sensitive not just to the cultural needs or the LGBTQIA plus needs, but both of those issues. And of course, the decision about which medication to use next ought not to be the clinician's decision. This is where shared decision making can shine a spotlight on the
Yes.
patient's individual needs, keeping in mind what didn't work, what's appropriate, what side effects are not acceptable to the patient, and going with that. And also perhaps considering intensive outpatient program or group therapy because the patient is actually quite ill.
Yes, absolutely. And so let's check back in and see. So we have all of these things that we know have potentially happened. And so let's specifically talk about Ale and see how what has been accomplished now that we've done some of these things, what else he might need, and what can you tell us about his case and how he's doing?
Yeah, Ale is hanging in there. Ale is tough. Ale has a core of
Resistant.
steel inside him. I can tell already, but Ale is hurting. Ale is hurting. Well, Ale's primary care clinician does start him on an appropriate adjunctive therapy, but the decision was made in collaboration, and the goal was to treat not just the associated symptoms, but all of the symptoms, keeping in mind because Ale does have treatment-resistant depression, that an appropriate medication to address that is started, not just another medication. Goal is not just to treat for the sake of treating the chart. It's
Right.
Ale who needs to be treated, right? The case manager is now involved, so the biopsychosocial intervention program has started. Let's keep in mind, such individuals really need the full court press. They need the full village to come together to help. And to decrease the use of the social media is going to be as much a part of the treatment as the biopsychosocial things that we just talked about.
Absolutely. Sort of cognitive feedback loops that are being created when you're sort of continuing to engage with social media. So absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the any door model?
Isn't that a cool term? And
I
if you
love it.
yeah.
Any door is a good door. Come on in.
There we go. Any door is a good door because one never knows which particular door a patient, particularly a patient like Ale, might be knocking on. It could be the door of the school counselor, it could be the emergency room, could be a primary care office, could be a counselor, could be.
Yes.
And the any door model is come on in, but this is not the only room you want to stay in. I have many other rooms. I have many other specialists. I have many other professionals. I have many other people who are motivated to help you. I want to connect you. So, as I'm showing you on this slide here, any door model is a very powerful way to do two things: to not let the patient's care fall through just because they appeared in the emergency room, for example. But the second thing is to appreciate that collaborative care is by far the best way to treat depression, major depression. But without a doubt, it's doubly correct when you're treating patients with treatment-resistant depression.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's so many populations that so rarely enter any doors that whenever they come through a door, it's like, thank you for coming. So glad to see you. Glad you made it.
Yeah.
Like a party. So, we have a cake for you. Here's some balloons
No, I
and
see what you
show you
mean.
some.
Yeah.
Exactly. Here's some love for you. And we have a whole team of people that are so excited that you're here. And so, I recently was on service in the hospital, and I say, I imagine, this is not what any hospital, CEO wants to hear me say, but I say a lot of our patients, don't have regular medical homes. And so when they're coming in, I envision this to be like a little tune-up because we may not see them as a healthcare entity for a long time. We're going to try and plug them in for medical care, but if they haven't had, their Pneumovax, if we know that they're engaging in high-risk sex behavior, we're going to give them a hepatitis vaccine. We're going to do like as many things as we can. We're going to show them as much love as we can. We're going to try and get them as engaged and motivated and build as much trust as we can so that we can open those doors. And
Love
so
it.
any door is a great door for someone to walk in.
So well said. And by the way, when they come in, the best client is a happy client, meaning just because they walked in doesn't mean we get to abdicate our responsibility to give them the best care possible, which you
That's right.
said. So even with treatment-resistant depression, the goal is not to churn them through the same old antidepressants after you fail two or three. Just churning through the same class of antidepressants pretty much means we're doing it to go through the motion, but we're not treating their symptoms. So thoughtfulness is going to be very important because a patient who does well becomes an advocate to other individuals in their community
That's
saying,
right.
hey, go see Dr. Peak. She understands me. She has helped me. I see you suffer. And they become a walking advertisement for more people seeking care, right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And we need that so much in our most vulnerable communities. We need people who are doing well, who can be their own living testament to say, I was not doing so great, but I had the help of a whole team of people who believed in me, and I'm doing so much better. And you can too. And that's what we need. And that means that we, as healthcare professionals, have to stand up and be our best selves when we see people who are coming through our doors who are clearly not having their best day. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming in to see us.
Exactly.
We may not be having our best day, but we've got to stand up and show up, and recognize that people are having so many other social drivers that, by definition, as physicians, we are probably not having. We are most likely ourselves not unhoused, not, having some of these other things that our patients are facing. And so trying to remember that there are so many other doors that people need to, have resources from, and having this, team-based approach where, in this case, they can see, the social worker, someone for community support, someone around digital education who can help with that, the mental health specialist, the case manager, their primary care physician, all of these people sort of wrapped, their loving arms around Ali, and to help him in his journey to mental health wellness. Any door is a good door, and then he can help others around him. And so I, as a primary care physician, we see so many people with multiple chronic diseases. We have to believe in team-based care, but it is so important, particularly important for, mental health care as well, that they know and believe and trust in those providers, because if they don't, they will not come back. And so thank you for just creating this beautiful imagery for us and for everyone who's listening to be able to imagine the kind of care that we should be able to provide for our patients. And so is there anything that you want to add that I've missed out in trying to sort of summarize what would be ideal?
No, really, there isn't. Other than to say it's a combination of knowledge and passion and appreciating that these health disparities are a fact of life, but not to get too pessimistic about it. Looking for opportunities to improve things is what we talked about today. And here's the good news. No matter how dire the situation is in Chicago or Houston or Los Angeles or Miami with a patient, there always are one or more opportunities for betterment. So I appreciated this conversation. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And so I hope that we've shared some very actionable strategies with our learners today, sort of walking through our patient case. And so I'm going to have a series of response questions to see how you all feel like you may have improved, hopefully just a little bit at least. So the first one, I'm going to ask about barriers to integrating social drivers of health screening tools. And so the first question you'll see on the screen, And so this is how significant are the barriers in your practice to utilizing an appropriate screening tool for drivers of health that considers factors such as culture, religion, and housing when caring for patients with major depressive disorder. And so again, on a scale of 0 to 9. And so now we'll ask about your confidence. How confident are you now in your ability to use an appropriate screening tool that assesses these social drivers, that considers these factors around culture, religion, housing, et cetera, when caring for patients with major depressive disorder? Again, on a scale from 0 to 9. And then last, how confident are you in your ability to manage mental health conditions with a team-based or collaborative approach? At least sort of thinking about who else might need to be on the team, and feeling confident in being able to reach out and think about the open door policy. You know, every door is a good door, on the scale of 0 to 9. All right. So this was an excellent discussion. Every time I talk to you, I feel inspired. I learn new things, and I really hope that our audience learned as much as well. So I'm going to try and summarize our discussion with SMART goals, and those are goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And so that's what I hope that our audience will take away from our presentation and apply to your own practice. So the first is to identify disparities in the diagnosis and treatment of major depressive disorder. The second is to identify the impact of disparities related to LGBTQIA status, race and ethnicity, and housing status, all three of those things sort of intersecting when caring for patients with major depressive disorder. Next is to integrate holistic treatment strategies, including thinking about social drivers of health when screening, into the care of patients with major depressive disorder to improve equity in treatment outcomes. And then to consider team-based strategies in the care of patients with MDD to address inequities in treatment outcomes. So this CMEO briefcase is one of a four-part CME CE initiative, and we hope that you'll take advantage of and participate in all the activities in this series. These activities cover strategies to address racial and ethnic disparities across therapeutic areas. I really encourage you to join us for the entire initiative because we're having a great time. By participating in these activities, you'll demonstrate your own personal commitment to improving health equity for all patients. So the CMEO D&I Hub also has a number of resources available to you to help further your own personal education on diversity, equity, and inclusivity. And so, Rakesh, I just really want to one last time thank you for joining us for such a robust conversation. I'm always just moved in my heart and soul when I talk to you, always inspired. Thank you so much again for being here today.
And you inspire me all day long. Your patients are lucky to have you. And I will say this, you and I are growing together. And I think we're serving as a role model to our colleagues. There is no such thing as fully grown. It's a
That's right.
process of growth. And I'm happy to go on that journey with you. So thank you, Monica.
Oh, thank you too. So to receive credit for this activity, please complete the post-test and evaluation. We really do appreciate your feedback. We want to hear from you to learn what you liked, how we can improve, and what additional topics you'd like for us to address. And so last, I just want to thank you, our audience, for your own commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Because together, all together, we can strive to provide the best and most equitable care to all of our patients, particularly those patients who are the most underserved. Thank you for being with us today.